I had a really bad November. I mean, of course, like the election was horrible, so most people did, but I had like a really like debilitating sense of like being knocked off my feet. Like I just did not know what to do. I had about a week and a half of this like dread that just wouldn't leave me, and it was largely based on like things I care about, people I care about, populations that I have, you know, empathy for, Standing Rock. Like there was just all these, you know, horror show, parade of horrors. And then like a week into it, it kind of hit me. Like I was talking to my sister and she was like, well, what does this mean for you? And I was like, oh my God, like I'm a convicted terrorist under the Trump administration. Like there's like 500 people convicted of so-called terrorist crimes in the US. And like, I mean, Trump has like tweeted at like Occupy New York people, like at the time, like he like tweeted at my friend, like some horrible insult. Like he's obviously a very petty person. And I honestly, you know, it was, I kind of had to like, what really pulled me out of it was just the fact that like all over the country, people were like starting to like really pull themselves out of this like existential dread, this like paralysis of like the first weeks, and like really go for it. And I think like, you know, I like most people made the mistake. I was like, oh, we're going to have like this really familiar enemy for the next 4 years, Clinton. You know, I mean, I was an activist in the 90s and I was like, yeah, you're just like your husband. And I know exactly how weak you are and how we can engage you. But Trump, you know, it's a new thing. And I think for some people, shutting down these like fascist events that are happening all over the country is a good focus. And for other people, it's going to be building up our power so we can effectively out-organize them. But in terms of what we're doing, what we end up doing, I think it's important to note, you know, with any engagement with the state or against white supremacists, there's consequences, often, you know, legal, but also medical, as we saw with Hex being shot in Seattle, that are really seriously. I mean, I already talked about that, but I mean, do people know that in Sacramento in June 26th mobilization, 9 people got stabbed and sent to the hospital. And this was the mobilization against, I believe what they're calling themselves is the Traditional Workers Party, Matthew Hamback, I believe. And, you know, they showed up and they were outnumbered. And when there were fights, you know, our side whooped them, but they stabbed 9 people. And like, we're not talking like slash marks, so like serious wounds in people's abdomens that required like, you know, thousands of dollars in care. And then recently, I don't know if people know, but the California Highway Patrol, CHIPS, I guess, which just cracks me up when I saw that. I was like, what? Suggested like 500 indictments for misdemeanor and felony cases for events stemming out of June 26. I mean, 473 indictments. So, you know, obviously they've been talking to the right wing. The left has not been talking. I mean, they've been calling people. They've been calling all the people that got stabbed. Nobody's talking to them, but they've talked to the right. And so I'm sure the right's got no compunction against snitching. I don't even think they care. And so, you know, we're looking at a situation where like California indictments are essentially going to roll out. And so we need to have people's backs. I mean, I'm an individual that essentially benefited from a tremendous amount of support. And so I think like when we're talking about anti-fascist stuff or all the resistance against Trump, we have to be there for people that fall, whether that's medically or legally. Yeah. So anyhow, I'm going to wrap up soon. I know I've been rambling for quite some time. I'll just let you know, since like 2012, I was released from prison. I was in the halfway house for 6 months and I went home. I got arrested for like a day for writing an article or for the Huffington Post. That was really ridiculous. But my focus, you know, which is probably not going to be much of a surprise, is building support for political prisoners in the U.S. To say that I was the beneficiary of like a silly amount of support would be an understatement. I mean, I was more so than most people received like a tremendous amount of movement support, and I'm like eternally grateful for it. I mean, it's kind of hard not to talk about it, but I had like a really amazing support crew, and they kept me with books and visits and money and paid rent and, you know, did so many things and so many like t-shirts and bake sales and benefits and like helping out my co-defendants and everything. I told myself, like, you know, this is sort of like that kind of like, You know, it's a bit like the lifelong debt that I feel, you know, not necessarily, not only to those people, but to the movement. I mean, if the movement is there for you, you know, I think that it gives people a sense of knowing that we're in this together, that if you fall, you're not just going to be forgotten, because there's nothing like prison to make you feel that you're gone. I mean, it's like that. It's like the Law and Order. I can't believe I'm referencing Law and Order again. I really, honestly, it's so addictive. I can't watch it, but I'm more of a SVU person, but I've watched it, but I try not to now because it pulls me in, and once it pulls me in, but you know the sound of the jail cell, the door, dun, dun, that's like, there's been so many times, like in the early, especially in the early time, where like, they like, you know, you're just like cuffed and dragged through a hallway, a long hallway, and they just put you in, and then they love slamming the door, when they, whether they slam it or they shut it like sideways, boy, they love that, and that sound is so jarring, and it really like, I mean, my first day I was arrested, they led me down this hallway that I thought would never end. It was like a freaking, what's the word? Not Escher, but it was like this ridiculous concentric hallway that just, I was like, where am I going? Like, and, you know, they slammed the door and you just think like, that's it. And I'm like really well aware of the good people in my life. And yet you put me in that situation, I have to like tell myself like, they know you're here. Like people know it's on the computer. You're not forgotten about, but that everything about the surrounding of prison is designed to dissociate you from that, to separate you and kill it, you know? I always felt that I was really lucky. I had a 7-year sentence. It's determinate. It wasn't like a 7 to 10 with parole, with chance. So I was, you know, I didn't have an appeal. So I never had that period of time of like constantly waiting for the bad news or the good news. I was with men that had 30-year sentences for talking about doing something. I was with men that were literally pushed by informants to do something ridiculous, told them no the whole time, but because they didn't, they were literally, this is the gymnastics, because they didn't then rat them out to the FBI, they were considered like the conspiracy. Conspiracy law is crazy. So I always felt really, you know, really lucky. I had a determinate sentence. It was finite. I can look at the calendar. I can do my calculation, know when I'm going home. So when I came home, I decided I wanted to help, you know, political prisoners in my neck of the woods in New York that, you know, were not doing determinate sentences, that had been in for basically longer than I had been in. Now, a lot of these men have gotten out in the last couple of years. I mean, a lot of long-term prisoners have come home in the last couple of years, like Albert Woodfox or Herman Wallace of the Angola 3. I mean, they're, you know, they were in prison longer than I had been alive. And so I do a lot of support for men from movements that I have a lot of respect for, like the Black Panther Party or the anti-imperialist movement of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. People like Herman Bell and Jalil Muntakim, David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes. I work in a collective called Certain Days, which produces a calendar every year. It's like an educational thing, but it's also a fundraiser, because we then take the money that we raise, which is usually, you know, thousands of dollars, and we give that back basically to groups that do solid work with prisoners, that that really like put prisoners at the forefront of what they're doing. And we also fund, I mean, this year we're funding Release Aging People in Prison. We're funding an indigenous blockade and homestead called Unistoten in Canada. And we're funding Adamir, which is a Palestinian group that does support for like the literally 10,000 Palestinian political prisoners. And despite, you know, this horrible administration, you know, I still feel that there's a lot that can happen in not only freeing political prisoners, but the prisoner struggles that are happening around this country, whether they're things like the Industrial Workers Organizing Committee, the prison strike. I think a lot of what happens in this country on the prison level happens on the state level. And so there's no reason to think that there can't be, that we shouldn't, you know, in addition to all this like reactive defensive stuff we're doing, that we should continue to push forward, you know. You know, they say the bad thing about every state is that it has a prison system and federal prisons and ICE, but the good thing about every state is they have prison system. And so there's no shortage of like areas to work on, and obviously no shortage of work to be done. I hope that people can check out Justin, raise your hand. Yeah, Justin back there with the red hat. Portland ABC, Oregon Jericho has stuff out there. Definitely really supportive of prisoner struggles. I was in the federal prison system, which is full of a lot of people that are not interested in organizing, because the federal government, the second you organize, they blast you. I mean, I got moved 3 times, and I was really not engaging in much organizing, but just anything. I mean, I was at Marion once, and they people did a food strike, of one day food strike, because they were phasing out beard trimmers, because beard trimmers are used for tattoos, basically. For me, it was used for my beard, and so I was like, really, like, I paid $30 for this janky beard trimmer, and you're gonna take it away. So I was like, yeah, I won't go to breakfast that day. Sure. Boy, the 25 people just get jacked to another prison the next day. I mean, that's how they handle it in the federal system, because they have 120 prisons all throughout the country. So it's really easy to take a New Yorker and stick them in, like, I don't know, MCCLA, and which I would obviously hate. Or in my case, they just stuck me in like various Midwest prisons. So I definitely am very supportive of prison struggles. And I do think that, you know, I think, you know, we have a, in the grand scheme of things, where we're talking about political prisoners, we're talking about people from our movements, but it's a small amount of people. And obviously the prison system in the United States is like 2.3 million, 1.6 in prison, 700,000 in jails, and you got all the ICE and military prisons. And I mean, it's an enormous amount. And so obviously my idea is never that we would just engage in this tiny group of people, but we find like commonality between our struggles. So I want to thank everyone for coming. I feel like I've been ranting forever. I want to thank Rad EDU, Amanda and Justin, Esther for the wonderful introduction. I am sorry that I've been talking for so long. It feels like 2 hours. I also just wanted to announce one event. It was supposed to be tomorrow, but it's going to be held on April 16th. It's called Fighting Charges, Strengthening Movements. It's going to be put on by the Tilted Scale Collective, who just made a really excellent book about how to be a criminal. Well, not how to be, but how to handle being... It's not that hard, I think, to be a criminal defendant. It's how to handle being a criminal defendant. It's at the Social Justice Action Center on 400 Southeast 12th Street. It's next Sunday, April 16th. We'll do Q&A. Thank you so much for indulging me and hearing me out. Thank you. I also just have one request. Don't ask a question that I wouldn't want to hear in court. So, if that's cool. If it sounds bad in your head, then just, you know? Thank you. And you're like, why would anyone do... Well, they do, actually, all, believe it or not. So, are there any questions? Does anyone have any questions? Just raise your hand and, like, talk loud. Go back in time, because there was a really good training here like 2 days ago. No, I don't know. Sorry, there was, but yeah, that's not useful. Security culture. I guess, you know, there's no like, I don't have like 8 points about this topic, but I will say this, like where I have failed at security culture has been not paying attention to feelings that I had internally, my own internal monitor about things that were creeping me out. Somebody asked me a question that I don't like, and I'm choosing social nicety rather than, hey, like learning boundaries, right? I was wiretapped in New York City by a person that has never been in New York City before and who had a crazy story about why he was in New York City. And it's interesting. I was table in for a conference. I was extremely tired. I had to go all the way to the northern tip of Manhattan, and I was exhausted, and I was sitting there, and I had myself in a position where I was, like, weak. Like, I wasn't, like, I didn't feed myself properly at the, like, that morning. And when I saw this person, who was someone I had committed a crime with, all the lights were going off in my head, but I ignored them, and I was just like... You know, all he had to do to that wiretap to the grand jury was acknowledge that we knew each other from the past and to not basically to not disagree with him when he made these statements. And so I was just being quiet and, you know, but I didn't disagree. I didn't say, what the hell are you talking about? I don't know you. I never did that with you. And therefore, that was enough. So I think trust in your gut, security culture. It could be, you know, there's a lot of opinions on the topic, and sometimes I think we can make it so that we don't communicate, but there has to be some kind of like, Yeah, you're talking about people that are full of piss and vinegar. Well, let the piss and vinegar out in front of people they trust, right? Because things that people say could be used against them and twisted. I feel like this is like my purgatory almost. Like, I have to admit, like, I said some stuff on that wiretap that, like, out of context was outrageously, you know, but when you read the full thing, you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense, you know. So I think the big thing is trusting your gut and maybe taking your time and building relationships with people and knowing a little bit more about people. I think that actually goes for anything. I'm not specifically talking about direct action. I'm talking about just like building movements, like, you know, and if someone is creeping you out, like, there's probably a reason why, you know. So sorry, there probably isn't one great answer to that question. Okay, thanks. Of course. Anyone else?
Since your incarceration, do you ever come into contact with mainstream environmental people, and then how does that conversation go? It's a big issue, like, how do mainstream environmental organizations either react to somebody who engaged in property destruction?
I don't really run into mainstream environmentalists too often. I usually tend to run into radical environmentalists. People that, like, you know, I mean, maybe that's that whole thing that you avoid places in which you're going to get a bunch of grief. But I actually, during the support campaign, we really tried hard to reach out to people. And not just directly, because I was in no position to reach out to groups. But we had, like, you know, radical friends that had, like, you know, I had worked for a lot of these different organizations that I mean, I have friends now that work for Greenpeace and RAND and all that. And I had gone to ruckus camps, which when they used to do that. And we tried really hard, like, reached out to, I mean, I'll be honest, we reached out to Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network and Ruckus Society. We reached out to Julia Hill, to Julia Butterfly. I mean, we reached out to, like, we actually sent at one point, like, a packet about the case. So like 300, 400 groups, PETA, every animal rights group and every prisoner support group and every eco group in the country at the time. It was like an enormous mailing. And some of that was fruitful, but for the most part, those groups were like, whoo. Some worse than others. The former head of Greenpeace, John Pascantando, they've had a million different EDs since then, but John Pascantando was really cool in that he was very clear with the media that we were not part of the movement, that we were troublemakers, that we weren't really environmentalists. Because I guess if you pursue a different strategy, you know, if you break the law, which Greenpeace breaks the law all the time, but in a very, you know, chill way, then that he decided that we weren't part of the movement. We didn't get a lot of help from any of the others. Julie Butterfly offered to write a letter. That was nice. I wasn't expecting that. We didn't get a lot of help from mainstream environmentalists. I don't know if you're talking about like the Gang of 10 or the Group of 10. I mean, those groups have no interaction with the grassroots, you know? I don't want to leave out any groups, but honestly, there wasn't a hell of a lot. And I don't really interact much with mainstream environmentalists. So I don't know, but often what I find with mainstream folks in general is they're, you know, my conversations with me, like if they don't know about like the background or, oh, everything's cool until you find that out. And then it's like a little awkward, right? Because they're like, oh, what? But yeah, I don't interact with them. I interact with like Earth Firsters and like, you know, climate people and stuff. And they all seem rather okay with stuff or supportive. So I would love to know. I'm sure it's discomfort though. It's okay to have a principled like disagreement with like those tactics. I mean, I have criticisms about those things as well. I just think like, as much as like sometimes like some like mainstream environmentalists can annoy me with their like nearsightedness and like myopia and like very narrow and stuff, and I still don't see them as other. I still see them as like, you know, like in some ways the way I see like some of my cousins are like conservative and like haters and Trump lovers, and you know, they like guns and whatever, like that's their thing. But they're still my cousins, right? I don't view them as like worthy of getting sent to jail because they have disagree. You know, they do dumb things, so to speak. So I don't know. I like to think that there's been more progress in the last 10 years with like convincing people that there's a reason people do things. It's not like nihilism. It's not like, oh, I want to destroy. You know, like I'm sure there's some people like that, but it's like means to an end. It wasn't like some like I love to destroy things, therefore I'm going to burn something. I mean, not for me. I don't, so.
I'm curious. I think that the folks who live here now who do organizing, particularly like climate and environmental and direct action stuff, like, it's often the narrative that we're living in the shadow of the green scare, right? And that, like, shit was getting big and we were getting effective and people were really doing things in the 90s, you know? And then the green scare happened, everything fell apart, and now it's wishy-washy. Now it's not big. Now it's everyone's actually really afraid of going to jail for 20 years, which is a real threat, right? And that, and we see it more. Like, there's historical evidence in a way
sure.
that there wasn't before.
Sure.
But I'm just wondering, like, how, knowing that you don't actively organize now, what's your perspective on that narrative? You know? And, like, how much of that, like, we were making gains and just, like, shit felt bigger when people were in their 20s.
Yeah, I think that viewpoint, I don't know who, I guess that maybe you're saying that that narrative is like widespread.
I don't know.
I can't exactly say that. I mean, I would not say that things we were making progress. I've actually heard that's a bit of a trope in some ways. I've heard it used in other ways, what was it? It was like September 11th happened right before there was supposed to be like a really big convergence. I think it was a World Bank thing in DC. And it was actually looking like it was going to be pretty big. And I mean, a lot of that was like East Coasters felt left out from Seattle, from the WTO. And they tried with A30 or A17, whatever it was, A17. It just wasn't the same because it's DC, right? And there's like, I guess, nothing to smash or whatever. I don't know. But... people, you know, I mean, it was a sensation. Seattle was like a sensational thing. It was like probably one of my favorite moments of like active organizing. So I get it why people might feel left out. But what I'm saying is like people were like, oh, if only September 11th didn't happen, then we... And I was like, you know, everything looks real different in the rearview mirror. You know, you don't see the wrinkles. You know, you don't see like the bullshit. And so I can't say that I felt like things were really great on the environmental level, environmental organizing level, and then the green scare, you know, screwed it up. The green scare is not synonymous with my case. It's sort of, I used it to describe like this increase in like these prosecutions, you know, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act being turned to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, prosecutions of things that had not been prosecuted before, people getting more time. My case, Jeff Lures, Eric McDavid, you know, and so I don't think that's true. I don't think that things were rosy and then it got chilled. I do think the green scare, now again, I wasn't in Oregon at that time, but what I do understand is there was a period of intense fear. Sometimes it had to do, I mean, you have to understand like a lot of people in my life like got freaked the fuck out when I got arrested because they didn't know anything. So it looked like I was just plucked out of the blue, accused of doing something I had nothing to do with. And that is a really disconcerting notion to think that like you're, you know, and of course we don't know everything that each other are doing. And so that's really what that was about. But so in that context, like I think like people in the Northwest that knew me must have been like, shit, am I next? You know, and that could have an effect on organizing. I do think there's things that like were deleterious to like organizing in the Northwest, like the Lauren, help me out. The ag gag, the interfering with agricultural operations, which is like, you know, because a timber sale is an agricultural operation, ridiculously enough. And so like interfering with that operation became like a way, like I think they were like doing injunctions or keeping people out of the timber sales. I mean, there to say that, like, you know, if what you're looking at right now is a situation where, like, the movement is, like, you know, not very active and stuff, and that's happened after the Green Scare, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean the Green Scare caused that. You know, I think it had part to do with it. I think it had a chilling effect. I think for animal rights, like, the AETA had a chilling effect, although I can't speak with certainty about that. I mean, these things are all very relative. But I don't think things were great and then the Green Scare killed it. I think people do have legitimate fears about things. I think the fear, though, that like you're going to get 20 years for doing nothing is a very different fear than you're going to get 20 years for doing something. You know, so like when my situation, our situation, my case, was we did all this stuff before September 11th, and then the world changed dramatically, the law, and suddenly I was like, huh, like this is a different world. Like the stakes are actually much higher, you know. But it's interesting. I actually had never heard that, but I hope that that's not too pervasive, because I do think it could be. It could be like the like an excuse almost. I think there's times that organizing is difficult in a lot of different contexts, and there's reasons also why organizing flares. I always thought that when I moved to Oregon, I was like, why the hell were there all this like forest activism in the mid 90s? But that there's like very specific reasons. Like the Salvage Rider had a huge amount to do with it. You know, I was at a club in New York City that used to sponsor like meetings. It was called Wetlands. They used to have like eco meetings and stuff every week. It's where I like cut my teeth and like learned about all these issues. We had like the Headwaters Forest Cascadia Roadshow. They used to do road shows. I think they still do. I don't know. The Earth First Journal is on a road show soon, I think. But road shows were big. Like they play music, you see videos, you get amped, come out to our campaign. It's like total recruitment drive. And they showed all these videos and I was like, yo, there's so many timber sales and so much activists. And then when I went to Oregon and I met everyone, I was kind of like, what's your commonality? And frankly, a lot of the activists were all at the U of O at that time, you know? And there's like geographical reasons, like the I-5 made for very easy, like north-south traversing, you know, from like, Sugarloaf, right? That's an old one. And all the different like timber sales that took place, you know, Warner Creek, Sugarloaf, all that. And but yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure the Green Scare had something to do with it, but I don't think it's what we should be focused on in terms of, I mean, we have to find a way to get past the fear, right? To find new ways of doing things, and maybe not repeating ourselves. There was a time where like occupying timber sales was the thing, and there was, I mean, God, and outside Eugene at one point there were like 5 sits, Winbury and Fall Creek and Elliott State, and you know, so yeah, sorry, that's not like definitive, but that's a good point. I mean, I'm curious about that. I want to talk to other people about that. Thank you. Any other questions?
I super appreciate that you talked about the lack of institutional memory,
yeah,
and the life cycle of activists, whether it be the individual motivation. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing so many more people come out of the woodwork now, mm-hmm, from like Main Street than I've ever seen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a lot of reactionary, mm-hmm, impetus for movement, mm-hmm, building or reactionary actions. And I'm curious if you can speak to the utility or the value for you personally in engaging in actions that took long-term foresight and strategy and planning and trustworthy, mm-hmm, and just the value in that.
Well, I'll say one thing about this concept of new people is that, like, when I first got involved, I find like everyone's origin stories are really interesting, and I often ask people like, how did you get involved? Because like I got involved as a 23-year-old, not in the punk scene. Like I listened to hip hop growing up. Like we didn't have like, I mean, there were metalheads and they were a-holes, and so we didn't mess with them in Queens. So like. Like the idea of like music and politics and the same was like, if those guys had politics, they were horrible. They were like racist. So I didn't get involved that way. I like went to school and I came home from college and I went backpacking in Asia and I met human rights activists actually randomly. And then I came back and I was like, I want to get involved in activism. And the anarchist info shop was so standoffish, except like one person, and he's actually a friend still. But really, you know, it wasn't a lot of entry points. But I met this woman who was collecting signatures for spay neuter, and I was like, all right, like, I'll sign your petition. I was like, I'm not into something different than this. And she's like, you should go to Wetlands. And so I went to Wetlands. And when I did, and I'm getting to my point, sorry, like I realize I'm just on and on. So I got involved in this community that was like, oh, I'm like, who's Paul Watson? Why are you writing him? Why is he in jail? Where are the whales at? You know, like, like, and they showed all this crazy footage. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I am like clueless. I didn't know any of this was going on after what, like, you know? And but one thing they did really good is they had immense amounts of literature they had out, and they would just give me tons of stuff. And I was like one of the first books they gave me, this is not the first book to give to a new activist, but they gave me like Agents of Repression by Ward Churchill, which is like a parade of horrors of what the FBI, but it really, of course, imprinted on my like ideas about like who I was up against. But I'm like, they killed that dude? Like, I was like, like, yeah, I mean, I saw a documentary about Huey Newton, and I read Malcolm X stuff, like, but I was like blown away. And but they, I was given so many like resources and under and patience, and people talk to me about like why is this not vegan, and this is, and why is this, and what's no compromise, and what is that, you know, what's hardline, and oh, it's garbage, don't pay any attention, you know, and you know, like, why do you all listen to really bad hardcore music? Like, why don't you listen to hip-hop or something? Like, and no, but it was, they were so patient, and I was full of questions, and I was just like, I mean, to the point that I was like suspected to be a cop for like 6 months, you know, like full on, like, that dude asked too many questions. I'm like, because I'm new, you know, like, I get it, I'm like older than you, but it's only because we are not in the exact same path, like, and I went to school and like cared about things, and I wanted to get involved, and I've been begging to get involved, like, so like there's got to be ways to like help new people figure shit out, because they're insufferable when they start, right? They think they invented resistance. They knee-jerk into really just like the mainstream, like they just come at it mainstream, like, which mainstream politics is like, you know, like, I don't want to say liberal, but they just have a lot of bad ideas. And so they often don't even realize that they're part of a movement. Or, like, I was talking to someone recently that was like, these people are so raw that they don't even realize that shit's happening elsewhere on this issue. And I was like, that's, like, next level. Like, I didn't even consider that, you know? So I try really hard now to, like, I'm, like, pretty aggressively I give out information like it's going out of style. Like, I try to, like, be patient with new people. I try not to be annoyed at questions. I try to, pretty much overwhelm people with books. Oh, have you read this? Have you read that? Amanda can tell you, I give her books all the time. And like, I'm always like, you must read this. And then I check up to see if she's read it like months later. But I think, and Amanda's not a new person. I just decided that I want to give her books, but no, not at all. But I know some younger folks, so I'm always like, have you read this? Have you read that? So you had a good part of the second part of... Yeah.
And I know people who have been organizing for years and are still very enamored with the idea of always being reactionary. And I see utility.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Yeah.
In making those actions. And
I think on a movement level.
Well, yeah, but I'm not the way that you engaged in for 8 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were reactionary actions that you took, but forming the groups of the people you worked with, the long-term visioning of having that security culture of...
Oh, are you talking about my support crew? You said 8 years. That's why I'm trying to... Are you talking about, like, action stuff or... Sorry.
Oh,
okay, gotcha, yeah.
Those were more long-term.
Yeah, for sure.
More strategic visioning, I guess.
Well, you make a good point, and it's one that I actually probably should consider more, which is that, you know, sometimes, like, things like heavy actions are criticized, you know, for being dangerous. And then the retort is always, well, you should see how much preparation, and you talk about the preparation. I've had these conversations with, like, my lawyers originally where I've been like, because they didn't know about any of this. And I'd be like, no, you don't really understand, like, the tedium involved. And actually what I think is relevant is, and we should all kind of like, thank you. we should, did she? Oh, you dropped something. She's like a hair tie. So disruptive. I'm just joking. Oh, man. Always the black-clad messengers. That's a reference to a super old zine, by the way. Only Esther got it, though. Thank you. Wedge got it. Wedge knows. One thing that I haven't done, and this is hilarious because you make a great point, is... I'm talking about the preparation. Okay, so, like... all this preparation into doing these actions, and you do it that way because it's dangerous. You don't want to hurt yourself. You don't want to hurt. I didn't want to hurt myself. I didn't want to hurt others. The point was not the sensationalist thing. You're like trying to achieve a point. So you do all this preparation. You make sure everything's safe and cool, safe, harm reduction, like safe as possible. And I would say to people that were like very critical of like these actions, like, if only you spent half the time that we spent doing your campaign, we would probably be much better off. But it's not a lesson that I can fully say I've actualized. And I never even thought about that point until you just said it, which is that we should approach like the work we do. It's not like just about like whether we're breaking the law or destroying something, but like we should approach the work we do in terms of like long-term building with people we trust. I mean, how do we do that is harder, but long-term with trust and like seriousness. And like, so I do definitely, there's a part of me that's like, when I'm interested in a topic, I tend to try to exhaust the topic. And sometimes it's hard because like it's topics I'm ignorant about, like the anti-fascist history I'm really ignorant about. I mean, I have like little bits of knowledge, like, oh, the White Rose or this, but it's all scattered, right? So I'm in this like long-term like learning process, right? But I do think that the reaction, it's so easy to be reactionary. And while it was happening a few months ago, I remember going like my partner and I had a weekend planned, and then the airport stuff like broke out. And I was like, oh, and I was having these pangs of like, I gotta go there. And I kept telling myself, dude, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You've been involved 20 years. You know better than to like, don't rush headlong into stuff. There's 5,000 people at JFK right now. Are you serving the movement and yourself best by being there? Because although I'm not on probation, and although, you know, I have technically no like legal prohibitions different than the average person, the perception that a judge or a prosecutor or a U.S. attorney will have on me will be a little different in terms of my ability to get bail. For instance, I would probably not get bail if I was arrested. They'd be like, oh, you have a history, you know, all they have to do is say terrorism and that shit kills everything. So I've had to like, you know, step back and remind myself like, you know, long term, like it's really easy to like get just to throw ourselves at it. But there's got, whether it's intended or not, there's a certain part of this strategy, and it's Bannon's strategy, and it's pretty naked and obvious, but there's a certain part that is about burning us out. You know, like, I remember I was very active during the Bush years, and people always used to say, like, does he even care? Because his public relations was, I don't pay attention, but, like, it all has been confirmed that he definitely paid attention. I mean, it's the same with Nixon and all. They pay attention. Like, if you're loud enough, if you push them, if you force them, they will change their horrible behavior. They all act like they don't care. And so the Bannon thing strategy is, I think, exhaustion. It's like throw as much at, you know, and we are like knocking away some things, and there's some shit that's sticking behind us, and it's going to become our new reality. The reality where you have to give a fucking password to a customs agent, you know, like we flew out here. This is our first time, and I'm always concerned about flying, and so we get there really early and all that, and I'm always ready, and we power down our phones because we're like, you're not going to, you know, I don't have my thumbprint thing active because you're not going to take my damn thumb and stick it on the phone and all that shit. But it's all new, and we were just like, you know, I think that there's a lot of danger in reactionary stances towards what's going on, and a lot of what could happen is that all the new people can get burnt out. Like, I realized that there was a period of time where I went to like 4 or 5 different events a week, like a few months ago. And I was like, oh, this ain't sustainable. Like, on a mental level, I was like stressed out. I was like, you have to be smarter. You have a particular, like everyone, we all have our particular strengths and gifts. And I'm like, you have something to offer, but it's not just being a body in a, and I say stupid protest because the one I'm talking about was stupid, where it was just like, we're standing there, like really wedged in. Nothing was going to get rowdy. And I, when I say rowdy, I mean enough that like the people in the building would be like, yo, what's going on out there? I mean, it was just real, like a tame protest is like such an oxymoron. Like, why have it? Why, you know? Anyhow, so yeah, I do think like, I don't know, how do we convince new people to like cool down? Because, you know, if they're young, cool down from an older person is like, it's like kerosene. I remember, like, I'd be like, don't tell me to cool down. The reason things are bad is because of you. Like, your generation. I mean, there was actually a period of time where, like, I mean, it's crazy. New Left people in Oregon, Portland, and Eugene were pretty actively trying to put the word out. You know, we want to talk, like old, you know, weatherheads, we're trying to talk, like, we want to communicate what we have to say to EOF people. But, you know, there was no venue for that, right? But it was obvious that, you know, and I was like, well, I would love to hear what you have to say, but shit, I don't know who you work for. Like, you know, I mean, write an article or something so I can read it, you know? But, like, you know what it is, like, young people full of piss and vinegar don't always really listen to people that have been around. And that's that messed up generation gap that exists where, like, when we're young, we're like, screw you. And then, like, when you have something, like, I struggle with the, like, what venue do I share any perspective with that's not, I don't know, shitty or I never want to be that person, you know? And so I like, are you suggesting otherwise? With friends is different. But with strangers, I never want to tell anyone what to do. Yeah, anyhow, during my case, I always said, like, I don't know if people know, but there was, like, a certain amount of comedy to this case. And not comedy, like, it was very serious, but the shit would happen in court that was just, to me, was irregular. And one of the things was the judge fixated on some of the defendants. Back it up. I'm sorry, I don't even know where to start. The prosecution said, kind of correctly, that we had these meetings, which were jokingly called book club meetings, you know, like a book club, like we're all going to get together and talk about a book, you know. Fair enough, it's vaguely accurate. The judge must have just come up with, like, this pun or this funny idea where she was now, during her statement where she gives the sentence to all the defendants, that she was going to have a theme to each one. But what I realized is that each theme was like a book, you know? So, and so I was really worried because I was like, I don't know what book she's going to pick, but I hope I read it at least so I know and I can at least be mad about, like, she's getting it wrong. But I was really scared that she was going to, like, she gave my co-defendant a book report to read, Three Cups of Tea, which is written by a plagiarizer, by the way, Greg Mortensen. He, like, created situations that actually never happened about coming under fire from the Taliban and stuff. And I was really scared that the judge was going to make me do some kind of arsonist, scared straight thing where, like, I was going to, like, have to talk. I know it's irrational now, but, like, at the time, she was coming up with these like, oh, you got to write a book report. And I was like, okay, that's unprecedented. I never heard of that. Like, and I'm like, what if I have to do, like, this, like, dare kind of? And I was like, and it really, but it's, I actually have a point other than the bad joke, which is, like, I don't want to be prescriptive. And I didn't want to ever have to, like, I'm like, screw you. Like, I've been through this. You got your pound of flesh. I'm not interested in talking to people about what they shouldn't do or what they should do. I'm like, so I'm kind of telling both sides, like, you know, screw you. I'm not telling people what to do. They need to think for themselves. And I'm also telling, like, people that are supportive, like, oh, yeah, you want to know what to do because you want to be lazy and not think about it yourself? Well, you have to go through that process yourself. I'm very deep. I mean, I'm in the process of figuring it out. Like, I don't have, like, conclusions on. I have, like, a lot of, like, what the fuck are we supposed to do now, you know? But I do think, like, your point is well raised, and I want to consider it in terms of my own, like, process of, like, I should be working seriously with people I trust and care about on, like, campaigns that, like, you know, that are serious, like, you know, that require trust and, like, you know, a lot of thought and analysis, because God knows we did it then, like, in terms of, like, really taking it seriously. And we should take the work we do seriously, regardless of tactical stuff. I mean, think about strategy and tactics and, you know, strategy first, you know. So, long answer, sorry. Any other questions? I'm sorry?
You said that she was theming your sentences after.
Oh, it was really weird. I've only read the transcript once, but it was vaguely, it wasn't Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It wasn't that book. It was a book about Justice Harry Blackmun, a former Supreme Court justice who I did not get the relevance. But there was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde mask analogy. So it was, we took a break. She went, I think, on the computer, looked on the support site, came back annoyed, and said, Yeah, because I think the way it works is that the defendant allocutes, makes a sentencing statement, as it was, and then there's a break, and then she goes through a rigmarole reading the whole thing. So what happened was she essentially said that I was pulling a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde on her, because what I said was so different than what, like, I literally had no access to the website. It was run by my support crew, and it was very chill. It wasn't like... I mean, it was like a defendant website, not the one like, hey, these actions are great. It was like, we support Daniel. He's from Rockaway. I mean, it was like very like, so I was like, you're mad about the site because she was upset about fundraising. So that I was fundraising to pay lawyers. That was a problem. So yeah, it was Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I wish she would have just picked that book because it's a good book at least. But I guess I was pulling like a, she thought the website was so different than what she saw in court. Therefore, who are you? You know? And then I pronounce 84 months, and here's why, and so, weird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the other one is like, any suggestions or advice on how to write good letter writing to business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, it is intimidating. But I'll get to your first question first. I think there's no quick approach to that. I think it's time. I think what happens is at a certain point, I was like a brand new activist and like, you know, I was talking about like being insufferable and know-it-all and stuff. And then over time, like, yeah, there is no fast way to build relationships with people. Trust takes time. And I think being real with people and like having, I think understandings, like I have people I'm close to that like I do political work with, and they're not always synonymous with my friends. And I think it's cool to have like friends that are not exactly like political clones of yourself. And I think it's better for self-development anyway to engage with like different people, people that like, because we all have like different sides. And so I don't think it's bad to like have like different aspects of yourself that are like complimented by certain people. And it doesn't mean that you have to organize politically with your best friends, or that the people you organize with need to be your best friends. There's some people I work with really well that like, you know, like we probably would not go to a show together or something, but like I really like them, you know. That's not a really great answer, but that's the first thing that came to mind. But yeah, it takes time. And the other thing you said about the, you, there's a lot to say about the bubble. Most activist scenes, I know that people like to refer to certain cities as bubbles, you know, Oakland now is the one to rag on. It used to be Eugene. And I mean, it's been Lawrence or whatever, but I think activist scenes in general are incredibly like inward focused, destructive in terms of like, sometimes I feel like there's a tremendous amount of like cleaning the deck of like a sinking ship that goes on. Like it's much easier to turn inward and frankly turn our guns inward than it is to face outward. It's not to say that we shouldn't be dealing with the way we're treating each other, because that's really important. But sometimes that it can be really intense and destructive in terms of like, it's not building, it's destroying. I find one interesting thing is the use of jargon, and I try really hard. It's easy for me to dork out. I mean, I like this weekend I've seen old friends, and it's been really easy to like just go there, you know, with like old stories and self-referential shit. And I feel like it's like when you go into an activist space and people are speaking in code, and you're just like, I mean, that's what I actually think it feels like to anyone that's new. And I think as real as you can be and relatable as you can be, it's not like a task to do that. I just think it's, for me, like eschewing like some aspects of our subculture that I think are just really off, not even off-putting, but like at a certain point, I feel like in my case, when I was younger, like, way I dressed or the way I act or even this, like, there was like almost a persona, you know, and like you put it on and it's supposed to communicate something. And yet if you're in political movements, like a persona, it's kind of like a, you know how like a lot of times at info shops, people are like super unfriendly and you think to yourself, you're in an info shop. People are coming in. It's like the bad version of like really dated reference, a record store guy. Like that record store person was, I'm sure in Portland, they're still here, but like they're horrible people. Like I went to like, what is it? Not wooden shoe, Lucy Parsons. Wooden shoe. Wooden shoe person was seriously shy. And like shyness is cool. Like I get it. Like I get shy sometimes, but if I'm behind a counter at an anarchist info shop, shyness is like that. I mean, you gotta look up and say hi, you know, like just hi, or can I get, I think they had coffee or something, like I don't know, like. And so I think like it's okay to be like, talk to fucking strangers or talk to people. Like I think the less jargon the better. I think the more relatable. I think like people, Trump or otherwise, like people are not like indifferent or clueless about like the fact that like this world we live in is like faced with really serious problems. I think people turn away from it because it's painful, right? And so obviously like I think that is destructive, but I think like just talking to ourselves like subculturally with our little jargon is really tedious, and as much as that could be like jettisoned, the better, you know. And I'm not suggesting that there's not a time and a place for that, but like it's really like movement, it's deleterious to like attracting anyone other than what ends up being carbon copies of ourselves, you know. Writing letters to prisoners, nobody writes letters anymore. I don't even know how like the post office works. I think it's like I used to say it was like Netflix and letters for prisoners, but nobody gets DVDs. So like it's really just, it's like, I don't know how it even operates, but I'll say that like letter writing is a lost art. Like when I was a kid, like I had pen pals, like, which is bizarre to think. I know someone actually that has their best friend is a pen pal from the back page of like Maximum Rock and Roll, and they're still friends. Like they grew up rurally, they were punks, they like writing their American friend from Canada. It was like really intense, but nobody does that anymore. And so what I tell people at these letter writing nights in New York is, you don't have to write like this epic like thing. I think writing a letter in which you share a little bit about yourself, it's kind of like a conversation. Like you wouldn't walk up to someone and ask them like 5 questions in a row without offering anything. But like there were times, I know it's, but that's exactly what a letter is. Like I have gotten letters, you know, and then like, damn, like this is vampiric. Like you're asking a lot from me. Like I'm very, I got a letter, so I'm very appreciative. I got a letter. That's like the baseline. But then I'm like, wow, like you asking about my case? Like, it's kind of like going up and being like, hey, what's your mom's name? How old is she? It's just like, you know, like, it's just random. So I always say, like, it's a give and take. A letter should be a give and take. It's like you offer a little bit. You maybe tell them what's up. Details, I think, tell them, like, people, if you're asking about, you know, writing people in prison, I think it's really good to offer some stuff about yourself. It's okay to ask some questions, but maybe not a million of them. I think it's okay to understand that the person probably is suffering from like some like underwhelming amount of stimuli. And so describing maybe some stuff that's interesting or compelling, you would think that maybe, like, especially once you get to know someone, you would think, oh, I don't want to tell them about good things that are happening because, you know, they can't experience that. But for me, the experience was otherwise. Like, I would ask people to tell me what the hell's going on in their life, because it was like somewhat of a vicarious thing where I would be like, okay, well, you know, I'm really glad, like, you know, that so-and-so got married, or that so-and-so floated the Grand Canyon and sent me a postcard on a mule, which is a true story, people in this room. So, you know, so I was really like excited about hearing about people's lives. So I think it's good to tell people, like, and I think it's cool to share political stuff. I think, like, you know, it's again, like, understanding that people are reading that letter, depending on the facility. Somebody is like definitely open in it. Depending if you're writing someone that has like politics or like is organizing, they're reading it, they're probably copying it. It's not going to get you in trouble. But if you wrote a letter and you said some crazy shit about whatever, fill in the blank, then yeah, that could, you know, they could be like, well, this person's not going to get approved to visit because they just made some joke about, you know, prison break or whatever, you know, like the show, not the concept of breaking, right? So, yeah, I think like start slow. I think it's cool to like send someone like, if you're like, you know, like they have like these materials on the back, you know, you can read a little bit like people's bios. You're like, oh, this is cool. Marius Mason's a good artist and is from like Detroit. I'm from Detroit, or I hate Detroit, or I don't know, whatever. But I got, oh, you know, here's a perfect example. Marius Mason's cat is like, cat's passed away, I believe, or are very sick. So obviously everyone here probably likes cats or dogs, or I don't know, maybe not. Maybe I'm being really assumptive, but I love cats. So I would write, if I was able to write Marius without getting Marius in trouble, I would write and be like, yo, your cat is mad cute. Like, I saw the picture. I'm sorry that they're not doing well. If it killed me that I wasn't able to, like, you know, I mean, and realistically, like, it did kill me that I wasn't able to interact with animals in prison. I mean, we fed feral, you know, cats and raccoons because we were like so happy to like, oh my God, we're interacting with something different at like in prison, you know? So, I think sharing stuff, keeping it short and sweet, you know, never promising stuff that you don't intend to, you know, which that doesn't come up in the first letter, but you know, sometimes people are like, they are well-meaning. They're like, oh, I want to help you. But like, don't put yourself out there too much. Be really clear about what's going on. Like, you know, and if you're out of political prison or letter writing night, don't say the first thing. They'll get 20 letters that say, hey, I'm at this letter writing night writing you. It's just like, I understand it's inescapable, right? Because you want to tell them like where you are, but it's always so funny. You're like, oh, I got all these letters on the same day, and they're oh, you were at the base? Oh, you were at, you know, the info shop? Like, cool, you were at, you know, Social Justice Center. It's really funny. Like, it's like, we used to laugh, like I used to say to Andy, like, Andy, did you get the letters from like from the New York City ABC site? Because I just got 25 of them, and we're like, wow, it's like so amazing. It's like great, you know. But and I would write people back and be like, yo, seriously, you didn't tell me anything about yourself, like, you know. But the other thing you should remember is, you know, sometimes people don't write back, and you shouldn't take that personally. There's a million reasons why they didn't get it. They're depressed. They literally can't write a letter because they can barely function. They don't have stamps. They have a limited amount of people to print labels out. In the federal system, you have to like revolve people around. It got lost. I mean, there's like the post office lost it. The prison censor lost it. I mean, my mail used to go haywire, and I would always be like, I wonder why I didn't get that one, you know? Then I'd get like a rejection letter like a month later. So, but I think, pen pal relationships with prisoners are really fruitful, and I think that they're a really good first step towards like learning more about the prison system and like how, and, you know, it's not just a one-way thing. I think like I used to write a lot of elders because like I felt like they had a lot to offer. I used to write Marilyn Buck back in the day. She's a prisoner. She actually got out of prison and died like 3 weeks later. She was very sick, and they got her out on like basically medical parole. She's a white anti-imperialist. She actually took part in freeing Assata Shakur from prison in like 1979. She's a really interesting person, excellent politics, and you know, my parents' age, so it was like kind of interesting to engage someone politically that age, you know, that's that much older than me. And I wrote her for years, and I always found like really good back and forth, like a peer, not a peer, like more like an elder mentor kind of deal. You know, she had really, I remember I was at the Earth First Journal once, and she wrote a really good letter about like Israel, because there was something got into the journal that was like not, it was just like talking about environmental stuff in Israel with like no real mention of like the situation, like the context. And so she was kind of like, you know, so anyhow, any other questions? I can go on all night. You do my comedy. No? No other questions? None? Okay, going once. All right, thank you, everyone.
All the partners to play. All of them. somebody already asked for it.
I missed your talk,
right, yeah.
See, because I was guarding a door.
Oh, yeah. Letting people in, I got lost.
Right.
Like, I was like,
All right, brother. It's good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Be in touch.
Absolutely. It's good to check it out.
And I will read your book. It is on my list. I gotta get through Sean's book.